In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
We've said before on this show how so much of the far left and their policies is driven by hate. That's why some of them on the far left express their disappointment that the shooter missed. I suppose the hate shouldn't be surprising if so much of your world revolves around controlling government and maintaining power so you can force your ideology on other people, because it is so weak on its own that people wouldn't want it otherwise. An attack on your ideology and the bureaucracy that enables it is a literal threat to your world. And I'm sure you, like me, wondered if the attempt on Trump's life was a hit ordered by someone in our government. Because one of his biggest accomplishments in his first term was to go after the bureaucratic state by removing thousands of regulations. And that's a threat. The deep state hates that. Regulations are what gives them so much of their power, setting the terms and conditions by which hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars are handed out. Needless to say, going forward, there are a lot of unanswered questions. But we're going to start our show today talking about the demise of the Chevron deference and good riddance to it. I'd like to welcome Craig Rucker. He is the president of the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, or CFACT. Craig, it's great to talk to you again.
Hey, Mark. Great being on your program. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome back. And, you know, you guys have got to be feeling just fantastic about the Supreme Court striking down Chevron. What was the mood over there at CFACT like when you got news of this ruling?
You know, it was really an uplifting thing, but it's really kind of consistent with what the court's been doing lately. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had the Sackett decision on wetlands that goes back a little bit, and then you have the West Virginia versus EPA, which kind of threw out some of the greenhouse gas regulations EPA was doing. So when it came to Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, which is kind of the case that was used to overturn the Chevron versus an RDC case back in the 80s. This was really just to be the final nail in the coffin that a lot of these regulatory agencies, which have had kind of a field day interpreting vaguely worded laws,
right,
that these have kind of come to an end.
Yeah.
Thank God they have.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been going on for decades. This is ruling back in 1984. And so let's maybe define a little bit for our audience what the Chevron deference is or now was. In a town hall report, you said that the Supreme Court's 1984 Chevron versus NRDC decision set the stage for an accelerated expansion of federal regulatory power, the likes of which America had never experienced before. So talk to us a bit about that and what happened after Chevron went into effect.
Yeah, this goes back to the Reagan era. And basically, there was the NRDC, you know, kind of came to bat for the regulatory agencies. And what happens is that when there is a dispute, Congress, of course, is supposed to pass the laws, and the it's then interpreted sometimes by the regulatory agencies, you know, EPA, using them as an example, to come up with how vaguely worded portions of that law should be interpreted. Well, they have through the year, when they've given them that license, been able to be very creative. They find excuses and vaguely worded laws to regulate just about anything they want to regulate and however they want to regulate it. And when a company complains about that and wants to, you know, say, hey, you're going a little bit too far, the courts traditionally have deferred to the regulatory agency's expertise and gone with whatever the bureaucrats say it is. And that's left really the private sector and citizens defenseless to the regulatory state.
Well, you know, Chevron, I think, didn't just impact agencies and gave them a lot more power. In some ways, I think it also really impacted Congress, because we began to see this era of Congress getting pretty much lazy and handing so much of the rulemaking that should have been inherent in those laws, and they just handed it over to agencies, and then they could head off and go to their cocktail parties.
You hit the nail on the head. And what a lot of times would happen is the Congress would see the way the agencies are interpreting the laws and get upset by them. And then of course, try to overturn them. But all it requires is for the opposing political party to have either one of the houses of Congress or maybe the president, and they can veto it or stop it.
Yep.
And so, in essence, we had a runaway regulatory state where the bureaucracy was making all the rules.
Yes. Well, to me, Chevron always had two built-in problems. One, it effectively allowed bureaucrats to decide for themselves how fair and appropriate the regulations were that they had created. I mean, deciding for yourself how fair you are is always going to be problematic, especially if you have no skin in the game. It doesn't hurt you, and you can't be held liable for millions or even billions of dollars of damage you do to companies or entire industries. And then secondly, it really opened the door to abuse by activist bureaucrats who wanted to twist things towards their own ideology. I mean, if you think the timber industry is evil, you will find experts who believe that as well. Is that how you see some of the problems there with Chevron, or do you have a different take?
No, I think you're completely right. I use probably one of the most easy to understand ways when you get a concrete rule is to look at the way they handled wetlands through the years. Mm. Now, that's been curbed back by the Sackett decision and other Supreme Court decisions. But initially, what was actually passed was that, you know, Congress gave Army Corps of Engineers and others the right through the Clean Water Act to regulate navigable waters of the United States. Now, an agency's interpretation, so long as it's quote unquote reasonable under Chevron, should be allowed to rule. But what is reasonable? So they took something, navigable waters of the United States, and basically used it to, you know, regulate ditches.
Yes.
And places with intermittent water. And in some cases, the water didn't, the ground didn't even have to be, where the water was above the ground. It could actually just be saturated ground that goes for, you know, a month, a year.
Right.
Is a navigable water. That's unreasonable. And, but they were given the deference to continue regulating it, and they did. They basically could control all land use in the United States by the definite, by being allowed to take what should have been a clear-cut definition, and, you know, they deferred to the bureaucrats.
Yep, they sure did. Okay, time for a break. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the demise of Chevron, one of the most onerous rulings to enable the bureaucratic deep state, and now it's gone. Good riddance. But what next? We'll talk about that next with Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT. And then in the bottom half of our show, we'll be talking with Scott McEwen about the assassination attempt on President Trump. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back. We are talking with Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT. That's the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. You can find out more about the terrific work they do, get access to their articles and research, and so much more at their website at cfact.org. That's cfact.org. And we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 14-29. And we're talking about the demise of the Chevron deference, which is also called the Chevron Doctrine. This was recently overturned by the Supreme Court. And just to give you an idea of the impact of that one ruling from back in the 1980s, the Chevron deference was referenced by federal courts more than 18,000 times since it was first put into place. And, you know, just to maybe back up a little bit, why did the Supreme Court back then in 1984 think that Chevron was a good idea? Or did they just simply not envision that the agencies would be grabbing so much power for themselves and Congress would be giving up so much power?
You know, it's a good question. My sense of it is, and of course, I guess I'm old enough I can remember back then, but you did not have the quite divisiveness that you have today, even back in those days. I mean, there was, of course, the two political parties, and but you had a sense of rule of law.
Yes.
And you had a sense that people would say, you know, I don't agree with you, but I respect your right to say it. It was just a less contentious time period. And there was just kind of a thought that people kind of would abide by the rule of law. And I think they did, more or less. But as times have changed, I think power has a tendency to corrupt. And
yes.
Through the years, these agencies found reason to get more and more authority to them. Now, I do think the system kind of rewards authorities with getting more and more aggressive with what they implement. And the reason I say that is you get more budgetary money. I mean, if you're regulating an endangered species and that species recovers, then you lose your budget. But if you regulate it and it's still a problem and you find five more subspecies to regulate, well, you get more money to now monitor all these other subspecies.
Right, right.
And the same is being true with Superfund laws, and that's another one that could be coming into review, because you started with maybe a few major toxic chemicals, lead, cadmium, maybe, PCBs and other things that were talked about when the law was originally passed. All of a sudden, you're getting into very minuscule types of chemicals that now are deemed to be toxic. And they're only toxic because they pummel a rat with about 10,000, you know, the equivalent of 10,000 tons of it in them, and then they get cancer. And now all of a sudden that becomes a poisonous chemical and needs regulation. And, you know, it goes on and on. These regulatory agencies have kind of a incentive to stretch the law.
Yep. You know, I think that's the right way to put it, is they are incentivized to keep regulating. So one of the factors of Chevron was the role played by administrative law judges. Were administrative law judges an outgrowth of the Chevron doctrine, or had administrative law judges been around before Chevron and then they just took a more active role?
That's a good question, and I would like to be able to give you an answer to that. I don't know if they were before Chevron. I don't have a memory before then, but certainly they've been, their caseload has been building up since then. And what you find too is that even without the Chevron deference, there were a lot of people challenging these laws. And, you know, if you believe the stats, I think it was The Hill that reported, even without Chevron deference, the courts were even shooting down about 30% of the things that regulators were doing as just being out of bounds. So there has been some rectification even before this law, but hopefully now that it's come online, it'll be easier for companies to defend themselves, for individuals to defend themselves when they feel that the government's overstepping its bounds as, you know, defined by Congress.
And so correct my explanation here if it's incorrect, but the way that an administrative law judge works, just so people understand the difference, is it's not a normal court of law where you're, you know, coming before a jury. These are law judges within the agencies that hold hearings and decide for themselves. Was there, well, let's start there. Is that effectively correct, the way that I explained that?
Yeah, it is effectively correct. That is what they do.
Once they made their decision, was there any way to vacate an administrative law judge's decision, or did it become effectively carved in stone at that point?
Well, it becomes carved in stone. You can always take it outside a federal district court or some other venue to try and challenge these things. But again, because they defer back to Chevron deference, a lot of times the regular courts do, pretty much the way the administrative court rules it, you'd have to have a pretty solid case of trying to overturn that, because again, the deference was given to them.
The SCOTUS blog had after this ruling had come down, SCOTUS blog had written that under the Chevron doctrine, if Congress has not directly addressed the question at the center of a dispute, a court was required to uphold the agency's interpretation of the statute as long as it was reasonable. So in that scenario, who determined reasonable?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the administrative court, of course, would be first, but then you would ask that you could take it outside to a regular court, a federal court, to try and see if, in fact, what they had determined was reasonable. And almost unanimously, it would always defer back to, so it was a circle that was going on. And for the most part, that was not, that's the whole reason. I mean, these fishermen, you look at this particular case in the Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, which is the actual name of the case that actually overturned the Chevron deference. You had the National Marine Fisheries interpreting the law. They have to regulate the catches of the different fishermen. And so in order to monitor it, they required the boaters to actually pay for government monitors or people that would monitor their catches. And they said the law gave them that sort of interpretation. And that was something that the fishermen said, hey, wait a second. It's one thing if you want us to have a certain amount of catch and everything else like that, but if you want to put regulators on the boat, that's something the government should pay for, not us.
Right, exactly right.
And, that's essentially what the court deemed was the case.
Yeah. Well, you know, when agencies are determining how fair and reasonable their own rules are, it's a bit like an accountant doing an audit of themselves. So All right, it is time for a break. We're talking about the demise of the Chevron Doctrine. We're doing that with Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT. Find out more about them by heading to CFACT.org. That's CFACT.org. And welcome back. We're talking today about the demise of the Chevron Doctrine, or deference. It goes by both, and we're doing that with Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT, the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Their website is cfact.org, C-F-A-C-T.org, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com on show 14-29. And it seems to me a big means by which agency bureaucrats were able to do what they did was through the tyranny of experts. They had their own effectively government-approved experts, and it felt like no matter how many experts you had on your side, even if they were far more competent than the government's experts, the government experts always won out. It was effectively a rubber stamp wielded by experts to approve whatever the government wanted to do. Do you see that role changing now? Will they be forced to bring in and to listen to, or at least equally weigh, experts from the other side?
Yeah, we're about to find out. We actually launched a lawsuit against kind of Biden's EPA and Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, as well as Dominion Energy on their offshore wind. We were very happy when this decision came through, because up to this point, we had to depend on their whale experts to make all the decisions. So we could bring in an expert or two that was brave enough to maybe right. be attacked or be defunded if they ever step forward. But even if they were brave enough, the deference would be given to their scientists. So it kind of forced us to have to go a regular, kind of a procedural route to try to take these on, as opposed to a scientific route. I would think with Chevron deference, we can now actually take them on the science as well. And that's good news, because we do have a bunch of scientists and statisticians that would love to take on the government. But up until this point, it was kind of fruitless, because they would just defer to there. So I do think it's going to have an impact on that, on future cases. Now, they did kind of say in this whole decision that they didn't want to relitigate those decisions which were already decided Chevron. So the court was very clear on that. However, these rules sometimes get modified. If there's new things that they add on to it, or there's changes, they could take it to
court.
That's
your opening.
So that will. I don't think that it's necessarily settled the case. And so, on a whole bunch of different matters dealing with electric vehicles, and they're trying to get rid of cars, to corporate climate disclosures and Superfund laws, Clean Water Act laws, all these different things. They're set in stone for now, but if they try to tamper with them or change them, they open themselves up, and I think Chevron deference would be able to apply to them then.
Well, you had mentioned there about bringing in scientists and experts, as long as they're willing to risk being defunded. I mean, that was always a danger there, but did you ever see that happen in practicality, where somebody actually lost their funding because they dared to submit expert testimony against the government?
Yes. There's a guy named William Gray, and he was probably the world's foremost authority on hurricanes. And this goes back to the 90s, and he would actually walk or give little tours. So whenever there was ever a hurricane anywhere, they'd bring this guy on. And wonderful man. He passed away now. But after he went forward to the government, when Al Gore was making noise about climate change, and said that it's his experience that hurricane intensity is not increasing, nor is the frequency increasing. He basically said the truth,
right,
and opposite to everything the climate alarmists are saying. All of a sudden, the funding that he got for his department in Colorado went away, and was moved to Florida, where the people happened to agree with Al Gore. So he was very upset by this, and indicated that it was because of his testimony and because of him going against the government. Now, it wasn't a regulatory agency, but it was still going against what the narrative was, that the government was saying. So I you do see that happen.
Well, I certainly hope that with this ruling, we're going to start to see less groupthink with these experts, and ones that are willing to start thinking independently again, because when your funding depends on the agencies and the governments, it'd be nice to have that threat removed. You know, it hasn't been very long since this ruling came down, but have you seen a change over there in the EPA, you know, at least in terms of mood or maybe some of these other agencies? Are you getting any sense of that?
Well, I would say during the Biden years, it's actually gotten worse in general. I was appalled that they were actually moving as much as they were. And I'll take electric vehicles as a thing, trying to get rid of the internal combustion engine. There's nothing that Congress passed, clean air wise or otherwise.
I actually meant since the Chevron deference ruling came down, have you sensed a change of aspect over there at the EPA?
Oh, since that came, well, it's fairly recent. So
sure.
No, I haven't. I do know, other than the fact there's a bunch of writing going forward where everybody's talking about the end of the world and that they're all panicked. That we got. But what actually has tangibly happened, I haven't seen too terribly much. I see a lot of, saying in their fantasies, kind of, that they think the world's gone upside down and that we're now going to see our pollution levels increase and corporate greed go out of control and human health and the environment's going to be put at risk by it. But, other than just pulling their hair out and being upset by it, I haven't seen anything tangibly happen.
Mm. Well, it would be nice to have been a fly on the wall there at their local pub and see them crying in their beer, because I suspect that's probably what began to happen there. Craig Rucker, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been great, and we'd definitely like to have you back soon to talk more about this Chevron deference ruling sometime in the near future.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
And welcome back. We're now in the second half of our show, and we're going to be talking now about the assassination attempt on President Trump. I'd like to welcome Scott McEwen. He is the co-author of American Sniper, the story of Chris Kyle, the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. Scott, welcome back. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well. Thank you for having me on.
So this whole assassination attempt is pretty shocking, and it seems to get more shocking the more you know about it. And I've put together a timeline to kind of walk us through the events. It's long enough that I think it's going to take up pretty much this entire segment and much of the second one. But before we get there, though, let's talk a little bit about some related issues, because until this shooting happened, I did not realize that the Secret Service relied so much on local law enforcement, including counter-assault teams and even sniper teams they'll sometimes pick up from local areas. Do you have any insights or knowledge on how that all works, that interaction between Secret Service and locals?
I do. I've got friends that have worked with both local teams and have consulted with and done training for up to Secret Service sniper teams. Some of my sniping buddies that were snipers in counterterrorism operations as well as in counter sniper operations in theater. Afghanistan and Iraq. So I've got quite a bit of experience. And what happens is you got your advanced team that will go out to these sites, Mark, such as this site where this is at. In a relatively urban environment. In other words, there's a lot of structure around there, whereas, you have danger zones, like, for example, on airfields, which are one thing where you've got a tarmac in front of you, and you can basically control the environment, the 360-degree shooting environment, if you will,
right,
where the president's going to set up or the speaker's going to set up. But here, you have a different environment because there's structures that are located in and around this one, the 138 yards from the actual podium, and so it creates a different environment, and they'll work with the local PD. They'll say, these are your areas of concern, these are areas of control, and that's one of the ways that they try and coordinate with local law enforcement, sheriffs, city police, and their anti-sniper shooters to help with the detail. Now, how many people, for example, this Secret Service team had on site that were actually doing counterterrorism, or I should say counter-sniper work, I don't know. And let me tell you something, given the lack of or the disinformation that we've seen so far, I'm not sure anybody's going to know for a while, Mark.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to sort some of this out. And there's a lot that we don't fully know. There's some conflicting reports, which we'll get into here in a little bit. But there's, I think a lot of this, especially, you know, we're only a week out from this. And so we need to make sure that we take a lot of things with a grain of salt. So I'd like to walk through a timeline of events that I put together. It's from various sources. There was actually some decent reporting from the New York Times and for once. And
the BBC.
Yeah, that's true. As always, I'll put all of our resources up on today's show. Again, that's show 14-29 at ispyradio.com. So let's go through this, and I'll ask you some questions as I go. And if I say something that really piques your interest or you think is really a really important point, go ahead and feel free to jump in there. But weeks before the attempted assassination, the U.S. authorities learned of a potential Iranian assassination plot against President Trump. Authorities claim that they did alert Trump's Secret Service detail about this potential threat, and there are conflicting reports about whether or not they gave him additional resources because of that threat from Iran. Some, however, are saying that the day of the event they had taken some resources away. Others, like CNN, are confirming that they had given him additional resources, although if they did, then that makes Saturday's bungling even more bungling if he had more resources there. On July 3rd, 10 days before the event, Trump announced the Butler PA rally. On a potentially related note, according to UC Santa Barbara's First Lady calendar, Jill Biden announced on July 10th that she would also be holding an event on July 13th in nearby Pittsburgh. And I say potentially related because there are conflicting reports on this. Some are saying that resources were diverted away from Trump's detail and given to Jill. Other sources are saying that is not true, including the Secret Service, which has emphatically denied any resources were taken away from Trump. So before we go further, any quick thoughts on that element of things?
Well, my first thought on that is this. We have an unbelievably close to this group source in Dan Bongino. And I know Dan personally. I trust him. I believe the man tells the truth. And he has personal friends that are still Secret Service agents that he was on, I believe, the Secret Service teams for 10 years. And the guy straight up, you know, operator. And so I know Dan, and Dan has reported unequivocally that, number one, there were resources taken from Trump and that they had asked for more resources but were denied. And number two, that the resources that should have been there didn't show up on the day that they in question. So that's two things. I think our best real source of information with respect to actual manpower that was there, or lack of manpower, or DEI/power, was probably denied, or at least in part denied, and we know that from Dan Bongino.
Well, we'll certainly come back to that, I think, because some of this timeline is going to feed right into that. So in the lead up to the event, there are also conflicting reports about the site survey that was done as part of the usual planning. This is when Secret Service agents get on site. They do that inspection like you were talking about earlier. The New York Times reports that it happened on July 8th. Susan Crabtree, who writes for Real Clear Politics and has some sources within the Secret Service, says it happened the day before on the 12th. According to Susan Crabtree, her Secret Service sources are telling her that Trump's regular Secret Service detail was so overworked they had been working 7 days a week without any breaks, that only one of his Secret Service detail was on duty that day, and they had asked for more agents, but that was denied. The special agent in charge was the only one there on duty, though. All of the other agents were substitutes pulled from other teams in the area. Regarding the site survey, whichever day it happened on, Crabtree says that a Secret Service advance team normally walks the protectees' route in and out of the site and then stands on the stage, much like you said, looks out 360 degrees to determine vulnerabilities, keeping in mind handgun and rifle effective lethal ranges to make sure those vulnerabilities are posted and covered. Somehow they failed to properly account for and protect a rooftop, a prime sniper position some 400 yards away. What are your thoughts on the fact that they left that rooftop open?
Well, first of all, I think you might have misspoke. It was 400 feet away. This is 138 yards.
Yes,
I've seen that from many different...
400 feet, you're 400 right.
Feet. So, yeah. Okay, that's 138 yards. Now, let me tell you something. First of all, you know, I'm not bragging about my shooting. I've shot with the snipers that Chris Kyle is his craft. I've shot with the sniper teams from the SEAL teams, et cetera. Look, let me tell you something. Any one of those guys makes that shot blind drunk in his sleep with his eyes closed every single time. 138 yards, I make that shot every single time. This is not a long distance, but when you're using a rifle such as a rifle that's semi-automatic such as an M4, which this guy had, or an AR-15, whatever they want to call it. the bottom line is that caliber, that bullet makes that shot with an average shooter every single time.
Yes.
So this is not even only a vulnerable position. This is an extremely vulnerable position.
Yes. Well, and I know that the shooting range that he went to, those targets were out 200 yards. So this should have been an right. easy shot for him. So they apparently did not do a careful job of spotting, because had they gotten up on the roof where that sniper team eventually took position, you know, behind Trump, their line of sight could have been blocked or at least partially obscured by a tree between the two buildings. And again, this is just terribly sloppy, it seems. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to continue with Scott McEwen talking about the assassination attempt on Trump's life. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to best-selling author Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of American Sniper and has his own books about the military, including the Sniper Elite series. And we have been talking about the assassination attempt on President Trump's life. And Scott, going out of that last break, I mentioned the sloppiness about that roof, that had the sniper team gotten up there to fully inspect that, they would have seen that there was a tree that could have possibly obscured their sight. And you had some thoughts on that.
Well, my biggest thought on that is, given the proximity, I mean, we're talking 130 yards of that position, which is has a slightly sloped roof, which we now hear from the DEI hire that ran the Secret Service, Ms. Cheadle, that was why they did not have a person up there, was allegedly because it was, quote, too dangerous.
Right.
Well, if it was too dangerous, then why was the sniper able to get up there and shoot? So that's just an absurd statement. That's an absolutely absurd thought. And then finally, Dan Bongino once again has heard from his people, there was a man assigned to be on that roof, and he did not show up. So that tells me that not only did they have a manpower issue, they had a somebody didn't show up to work issue.
Wow.
And they didn't deal with it immediately.
And in the one area that was vulnerable. I mean, that's not at all suspicious. You know,
very vulnerable.
It's ridiculous that this whole slope thing, it's absurd, especially for two reasons. One, the snipers that were in position that returned fire on that shooter were on a roof that had a steeper slope than the one from which the shooter fired.
Right.
Two, using a combination of an article that referenced the roof at a peak being 3.5 feet higher than the walls, and Google Maps to measure the width of the building, which was 80 feet, so 40 feet at the center where the peak is, and an online calculator, it comes up with a slope of 5 degrees. According to the ADA, that is nearly the same slope recommended for handicap ramps. Don't tell me that's dangerous.
Right.
So what bothers me, though, is did she come up with that lunatic theory on her own, or did somebody tell her that's what the issue was? I mean, and she believed them.
Well, that's why they don't want her to appear, even though she's been subpoenaed for the congressional investigation that's been ordered to start next week. And, of course, our friend Mr. Mayorkas says we're not going to allow her to appear.
Hmm.
So we'll see where that war goes. But they're going to try and drag this out, as we both know, as long as they can, because proximity to the event always leads to more interest, and they want to drag it out in the news cycle and see if they can get this behind them, because it is so damning.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, just the confluence of sloppiness is really suspicious, and I can certainly see why people are getting into different theories about why this all happened and all the rest. And you know, I don't know that I'm willing to go there yet, that this was an attempted hit on Trump by our own agencies. I think that's maybe a huge leap at this point, and we don't have enough information to make that, but I could certainly see why people have already connected those. So back to that timeline, the day before the shooting, Crooks went to a shooting range where he belonged to practice his shooting. The day of the shooting, Thomas Crooks bought 50 rounds of ammunition at a local gun store and a small stepladder from a hardware store. And just to interrupt that timeline there, the fact that he knew that he would need and bought a stepladder, to me, indicates he had been at that site previously, either earlier that day or in the days since it had been announced, and had scoped it out. I mean, why else would you buy a ladder?
Of course you have. He was casing the joint. Of course you
are. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So at some point, either the day of the event or the site assessment day, someone made the call to not have snipers or police on top of that roof. And as you mentioned, this was a glaring As Susan Crabtree mentioned, this is a glaring error to not have an obvious direct line of sight from an elevated position. There are some conflicting reports that police officers were at least inside that building, just not on top for some reason. About 1 hour before the shots, local police officers spotted a skinny young man acting oddly and notified other law enforcement. The Secret Service was also informed through radio communication, and then they lost track of him. 20 minutes before the shooting, A sniper from a distance spotted Crooks again and this time took his picture. Two local police officers were pulled from a traffic detail to help search for him. Despite this known potential threat, the Secret Service did not stop Trump from taking the stage, not even delaying Trump's entrance until they found the guy. That's one of the odder events that day. Why not pause 10, 20 minutes until the suspect was found?
Exactly. Joe Biden doesn't show up all the time for 30 to 60 minutes from the time he's supposed to start.
Right.
So it's a regular event for him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why wouldn't they delay when you know you've got a person of interest that you take a picture of? A person of interest is what they define him as.
Right.
Which tells me that they look at him like he is a suspect in a potential crime to be committed.
Yep, absolutely. So, okay, using the stepladder he'd bought, Crooks climbed up onto an air conditioner and from there made it up onto the roof about 3 to 5 minutes before the shooting. People began shouting and trying to get the attention of law enforcement and pointing out the man crawling up the roof who had a gun visible. Two police officers climbed up a ladder to look on top of the roof. The first one retreated and fell off when Crooks pointed his rifle at him, unable to shoot Crooks because he was holding onto the roof with both hands before falling off. Seconds after that encounter, he began shooting at the president, who was about 450 feet away. Absolutely miraculously, Trump turned his head to the right to look at a screen a split second before the bullet struck him in the ear. If he had not turned at that exact moment, the bullet would have struck him in the back of his skull, killing him almost instantaneously. And let me just pause here to see how close of a call and how really miraculous that turn of the head really was. People can try this for themselves. If you turn your head to the right and then take your index finger and put it along your right temple, pointing backwards, so the tip of your index finger touches the top of the ear, that's the path of and the entry of that bullet. And now, without moving your finger, turn your head and look forward, straight ahead. That entry point is now at the back of your skull. And not only that, but there was another miracle that I don't think anyone else has pointed out. Trump just happened to look to the screen at his right. If you do that finger thing again, start by looking to the right and holding your finger in place, and then look to the left, now that bullet hits square in the back of your skull. I mean, that was a miracle. Well, I mean, that he turns literally a split second before that bullet hits.
Look, I think the term miracle is very appropriate. I'm not a real religious guy. I'm telling you, something from God or wherever you want to say it said that Trump was going to live that day. I absolutely believe this was a miracle.
Yeah.
And I absolutely believe that somebody intervened. And, you know, you can say whatever you want, whatever higher power you want to point to. But the bottom line is something happened. I want to speak to something else that you just said, too. Okay, so the cop gets up on the roof. He sees the guy with a gun.
Right.
Pointed at the president 130 yards away and falls down and then supposedly gets on the radio and the radio comms didn't go, you know, mayday, 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 get him off the stage, whatever their term is to protect the president, is they must have that term. So they were supposedly on the radio trying to get this done. Look, you stand back from that building right there as a cop. You pull out your sidearm or your rifle. I don't know what this guy he was carrying or whatever else. And you start capping shells, Mark. And when I say capping shells, you go through everything in your arsenal before you quit shooting because you need to either get that guy through the roof, get back far enough to shoot him on top of the roof, or just bring lead in his direction because you are about to have the president and the future president of the United States about to be killed. You do whatever you can. Right there.
Absolutely.
And you must do that.
And if nothing else, shoot into the air. That would have gotten the Secret Service's attention,
no,
I would think. So
I don't care. You just put bullets towards the target.
Yep.
It doesn't matter. You start raising hell. You pull the button. You pull the fire alarm. You do everything you can to say, look, we're about to have our president shot. So you got to do something. And these people, it's a Keystone Cops. This is so incompetent. It makes you know, the trial that's going on with the idiot on the stead of Rust. You know, it makes that look like that was confident. I mean, this whole thing is just absurd.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a break. We'll come into our last segment here and finish up that timeline. And we're going to be looking at things that just are not adding up and questions that demand answers. And we're back in our final segment now. We've been talking about the assassination attempt on Trump's life, and we've been doing that with best-selling author Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of American Sniper, and who better to talk to about snipers and shooters than Scott McEwen? And so, Scott, I wanted to finish up the timeline here because there was a little bit of oddness there at the end. So after he takes his shot, the sniper team on the roof behind the president returned fire, killed the shooter within seconds. Trump's security detail surrounded him and covered him on the stage. Many experts consider that a really grave error, saying that they should have immediately rushed him off the stage, leaving him where he was and then standing up, left him exposed to other shooters. I mean, for all they knew, there was another shooter or two out there. And compare that to Reagan's attempted assassination. The Secret Service whisked him into the presidential limo in about 2 seconds. So thankfully, President Trump is alive today. I, as we said earlier, I think that was a true miracle that he just happened to turn his head when he did and was facing the direction that he was too. So you had mentioned during the break there that Chris Kyle had a similar situation. And we'd been talking about that policeman that should have started emptying his revolver, whatever weapon it was he was carrying, at that guy. Chris Kyle had a similar situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chris is an always shot. He was in a situation where he saw a troop approaching his position. He was in overwatch position, not unlike the counter snipers that would have been at this location. He saw an individual with an RPG that was about to ambush the troops just as they were coming up on a concealed position. He could see the sniper. They could not, or I should say the guy with the RPG. And he just started capping rounds. He started putting rounds downrange, and as much as he could at 2,300 yards, he ended up killing the guy at 2,300 yards, which is over a mile away. And just by fortuitous, you know, basically you empty everything you can and you get their attention because they know you're shooting in that direction. Plus you're trying to hit the guy. He ended up hitting the guy and killing the guy, and the guy couldn't kill our troops as a result of it. But my point is this. When you have a situation like this, when you know you are basically in a absolute death position for the person you're protecting, you do whatever you have to do. You make whatever means you have to do to make racket, to get led in the direction of that thing, and you start shooting at that guy immediately.
Yeah.
And those cops, I don't know what their story is, but you know, I don't care. He fell down off an 8-foot roof or whatever. Look, so what? You know, I mean, this whole thing is Keystone Cops. It's completely, at best, they're criminally negligent. At worst, they were a part of the deal.
Right. Well, you know, the whole Keystone Cops aspect of this, you have to look at this and you think, is the Secret Service always this bad? And we just never know about it because there aren't shootings at every event. Maybe it's just a constant mess up from the get-go. But what bothers me is that all of this blundering just happens to have taken place on the one day and the one event where a shooting took place. Especially yeah. since
and
it's,
all your
it's,
your DEI hires were there. And I'm sorry if this may sound sexist. I'm not being sexist. Your DEI hires, three women that are, President Trump stands 6'3". His detail that must protect him must be at least that height.
Right.
They've got 5'6" women that are out of shape, trying to pull their weapons out that are clearly, let's just say, DEI hires. And I'll go that far to say it because this is a DEI hire. She admits to the fact that that's what she tries to do. But at best, he had the B team with him, probably the C team, you know, with him that day, President Trump did. And the question is, why is that, Mark? Why?
Yeah. Exactly. And that's going to be one of those unanswered questions for a while. It does seem suspicious that he's got these. It felt very much like the B team on there. They didn't even seem to have a coordinated plan to getting Trump off the stage. And you would have think that that would have been something that they planned well ahead, that they'd trained for. They know the steps and said they laid on top of him. And then he was there a couple of minutes, it seems, before they finally got him off the stage. But, you know, again, it's the combination of blundering that just seems really horrible. And I can certainly see, as we alluded to earlier, how some people would think that this is a conspiracy and a setup. We know that our government has had people killed before. And you talk to somebody like a Tucker Carlson, who claims to have had a direct source, who saw the JFK files, and Oliver Stone, RFK, all of these guys have claimed that the CIA is the one that killed Kennedy. So given that, and given the deep state hatred of Trump, I don't think we can rule it out completely that this could have been a designed hit and not just some random lone gunman. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I mean, if you do rule it out completely, you're an idiot. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, if you think that our government can be trusted after what they've done, especially to this man, indicting him, basically criminally going through his things when they had no good warrants, all the other things they brought for charges, all the other ways they tried to take this man out, and to think that these guys are clean now?
Yeah.
Are we living in a counter world? This is, you know, these guys are capable, I believe, of just about anything at this stage. They do not want to lose power. They're absolutely deathly afraid of losing power at this circumstance. the guy that's in charge of the agency, that's in charge of the Secret Service, that's just let 14 million illegal aliens into this country, and you don't think they're capable of this? Let me tell you something. They're capable of this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we saw them more than willing to kill millions of people with the vaccine that they knew was untested. So, yeah, there you go.
That's not a conspiracy theory, my friend. Nope. At this stage, it is absolutely within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Unfortunately, the people that are going to be investigating this are the FBI. That's the same agency that started the Russia collusion hoax, knowing it was fake, got court warrants despite it being fake to spy on President Trump, and then inspected itself and found no problems, and certainly held nobody accountable. I don't know how you trust any government investigation at this point.
You can't. The only real investigation is if God gives us Trump back as president.
Yep.
Then the only real investigation will happen will be after that.
Yeah.
This is not over. This is not over.
Nope.
And whether the Iranians are here in force enough to threaten Trump or not, I don't know that. But I will tell you this: that's a good false flag operation if they wanted to try this again.
Yeah.
The man is in danger. I say he needs his own team of people that are not just Secret Service to help him. I know the people that could do it, and I'm not volunteering my stuff, but let's just say I've put my word in the right area to say we really need a counter-terrorist team from either the SEAL teams, MARSOC, or Delta that can be trusted.
Got to have somebody to be trusted at this point, for sure. So, Scott, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Mark, and thanks for having me on. Look, this is our country. We're taking it back. This is their last gasp of trying to keep control.
Yeah.
And it's going to get crazy between now and November, but as long as we keep on our course, we're going to be fine.
Yes, we will. After our interview with Scott, a couple more very strange things came to light. Again, these are first blush reports, so take them with a grain of salt. First, in regard to it looking like Trump had the B team that Saturday, apparently that is the case. Senator Josh Hawley has sent off a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas demanding to know why some of the so-called agents guarding Trump that day weren't even Secret Service. Whistleblowers have told Josh Hawley that they were instead unprepared and inexperienced DHS personnel. What on earth? And then this may be even more troubling. Congressman Mike Waltz says that according to an FBI briefing he has seen, the Trump shooter had 3 overseas encrypted accounts. This at a time we know that the Iranians were plotting against Trump. What on earth is a 20-year-old barely out of high school doing with overseas encrypted accounts? There will be a lot more questions going forward, and people need to be held accountable. And we hope that the information we're bringing you will help give you the tools to hold people accountable and to demand answers, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fake that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.